Welcome to the USCHoops.com College Basketball Podcast. USCHoops.com College Basketball Podcast is the original podcast covering USC Trojans men's college basketball team and is available on such platforms as Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and TuneIn, as well as at the USCHoops.com website. If you haven't done so already, we'd really appreciate it if you gave us a five-star rating and left a review on the platform of your choice. And a happy Tuesday, February 21st, 2023 to everybody. This is Chase, as always, joined by Nick. Nick, how are you doing?
Chase, I'm awesome. Great to have the sweep here of the Bay Area schools. And certainly we got some help this week from Utah and Oregon as well.
We certainly did, and we're going to get into all of that. Before we do, I just was listening to our intro, pre-recorded intro, and we talk about, like, the main platform to listen to the podcast, obviously, is Apple Podcast. And I was thinking, gosh, I wonder if, Apple Podcast will be the home of the Pac-12 media rights going forward, or maybe just the USCHoops.com, college basketball podcast itself will be the home of Pac-12 media rights, the way things are going here. But I don't know.
I think the rights to our podcast might be more than the rights to the Pac-12 these days.
And that might be the case. I don't know. I mean, I guess I don't know how much we'll get into this at all, if at all, this episode, maybe future episodes, because the thing has been such a, like, just, I mean, so happy that we don't have to deal with this situation. And I really feel for, like, fan bases like Arizona's and stuff like that, where, you know, they're looking at this every single Washington. They're looking at this every single day with dread. And the idea, like, the new, there was a report in the New York Post, and gosh knows how credible it is, that Apple Plus, which is their streaming service, which is going to try to get in on the media rights for the Pac-12. And maybe then the thought was, okay, maybe they're trying to, this was being like the Pac-12 was released in this to try to make Amazon nervous. I don't know if Amazon would be nervous or what, but, like, it's unclear from the report in the Post, like, what tier of rights this would be, but potentially, like, all the games would be subject to Apple. Maybe they would just, like, sell some games to Fox and ESPN. I don't know what this would come out to, but, you know, I first of all, I don't think this is going to come to fruition. I do not think that Pac-12 home will be, the future home of Pac-12 will be on Apple Plus. I don't think that's going to happen. But if it did, and they just absorbed the Pac-12 network as it currently stands, and kind of, like, all that really happened for the Pac-12 was moving from Pac-12 network to Apple Plus, but they lose all their tier one and two games on ESPN and Fox. I mean, I think people would be really, 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 really upset.
Yeah, no, it's definitely crazy. And if you want to read more about it, Jason Shears actually has done some really good reporting on the Arizona 24/7 site, kind of breaking everything down. And unlike John Cazano and John Wilner, who are these ADs who put out kind of Oregon State and Washington State propaganda, I think Shear does a really good job kind of getting into, you know, the root of the issues and what's really going on.
Yeah. And you know, it kind of goes without saying that the Arizona fans take this very, very seriously, even though they're not a football powerhouse. Obviously, the basketball program is kind of like royalty on the West Coast, but they're and tremendous fan base. I have to. For basketball, it's just amazing. But they're not a football powerhouse. But they, you know, they see which way the wind's blowing, and it's got to be absolutely terrifying. Well, look, we'll cover this more in depth in the future, and once we figure out what's actually happening, because everything now is just a rumor. And it's, like I said, I'm glad to be out of this. But, you know, we just played two of the schools that I think are two of the main culprits for the problems the Pac-12 has had. For different reasons. When I was growing up, Cal, this is the 90s especially, Cal was kind of like a cool, like a trendy program. Not only did they have the academics, and they had the hippie reputation for sure, but they were kind of like the Michigan of the West Coast, if that makes sense. It was like just kind of trendy marketing for Cal. They had some pretty good football at different points in the 90s. Russell White from Crespi, who was a huge, huge recruit in my era, decided to, you know, there's a whole issue with his academics, didn't go to SC, ends up at Cal. And during that period, even though he wasn't even the best running back on the team, Cal had this huge blowout against SC in 91, I think, at the Coliseum. One of the, I think, the worst loss SC had ever had at the Coliseum at the time. And I mean, the game was so bad that in the middle, like, Larry Smith, who was the coach at the time, this was like kind of the beginning of the end for him. He this is like the 10th game of the season. He decided to blow Rob Johnson's red shirt to, just because the score was so bad. So he waited to the very end of the season in a blowout loss, and we're already like have a terrible record, and just blew his red shirt. So the whole thing was a really kind of a cluster. But Cal at the time was, you know, was trendy, and you know, they had Jason Kidd, that, you know, Lamont Murray, Tracy Murray's cousin, was on the team with Jason Kidd, and then stick around, Sharif Abdul-Rahim would be there. They had a lot. I mean, Jared Haas played there, obviously. So they had a lot of, you know, kind of like good basketball players. It was a trendy school at the time. In the early 2000s, they obviously had Ted Tolner. And that they were the only, you know, after 2002, they were the only serious competition for Pete Carroll, really, until 2009. Now, I know Oregon had had that good season 2007 with Dennis Dixon, but that, you know, that was kind of a flash in the pan year for Oregon during that period, as they were kind of transitioning from their the Bilotti years into the Chip Kelly years. So Cal was like a power in, you know, in football, and they had been trending school in the 90s. It's completely fallen apart. They've had all kinds of financial issues of a lot of their own making. They had issues having to do with like complying with California, like building code and retrofitting their football stadium, which is on like a major earthquake fault. So I mean, some of this is a little bit beyond their control, but after the basketball coach who left for Missouri, who's, I always do this on the show, who's the
Quanzo Martin.
Quanzo, when he, that was like the writing on the wall, right? I mean, that was like the last bit of money they could spend on the coach was on Quanzo Martin, and he left. And from there, the basketball program has been a zero, nothing. I mean, the worst program in the conference since then. And then Stanford, Stanford was a basketball power throughout the 90s with Mike Montgomery into the early 2000s until he left. After he left, they were still a credible program for the next 6-7 years, and it's been steady decline since then. They obviously had this huge uptick for the first time in my lifetime, or at least since I've been watching, in football with Jim Harbaugh initially, and then David Schock had most of those really strong years. But that kind of ended in 2017, and for the last 5 years, they've been treading water downwards and drowning, kind of, and Shaw's finally out. And so we have two programs that both, you know, from, you could say from like 1991 through really through 2017, but a little bit earlier for Cal, they were power programs that they demanded respect, and now they're like zeros. And Stanford has had just a miserable year. I picked them to finish, to my everlasting shame, picked them to finish fourth in the Pac-12 this year, ahead of USC. They beat Arizona at home. So they lose all these games outside of conference, basically can't beat anybody, get a conference play, and then they start winning games all of a sudden at home, halfway into the conference season, just hurting everybody's standing in vying for the NCAA tournament, beat Oregon at home. And then, you know, we play them, and I got to say, I was not impressed with anything. I mean, we our defense played pretty well for the first 30 minutes of the game. I think we made our assignments. We rebounded very well. We took the game seriously. But for the most part on offense, it was kind of like we, you know, just kind of go out there and score, and they didn't really do anything, and they didn't put up much of an effort. And if we had actually, you know, closed out the game with seriousness and tried to rebound and stuff at the end of the game, we would have won that game by 20 easily. So, I mean, I was not impressed with anything I saw from Stanford. Cal was crazy. I mean, this Cal team was one of the worst teams I've ever, now without Devin Askew, one of the worst teams I've ever seen from the conference come and play SC for a home game, whether it's at Galen or the Sports Arena. So, anyway, those two are certainly a microcosm of the problems the Pac-12 has had. But And it's causing these like meteorites, just disaster. So any thoughts on all this stuff in the games? And you were at the game on Saturday against Stanford. So your impressions of all of that?
I was, yeah. I'll just start with the Stanford game. I agree with you. It felt like we could get an uncontested three against Stanford every single possession of the game, if we wanted to, and we made enough of them. Definitely shot a good percentage, but our looks were really, really clean. Yeah, and Drew had his mid-range going. Didn't really like the defensive effort in the second half against Stanford. We didn't play hard at all. But, you know, like credit to their guys, they hit, you know, their open threes in the second half. And I think they scored 27 or 28 points in the final 10 minutes against us. But the game never really felt like it was in doubt after halftime. So good win. And then the Cal game, man, like, yeah, I think I texted you early in the game. Like, you know, if we play hard the whole 40, we could hold them under 40 points, and we didn't play hard the whole 40, but still, I mean, 30, you know, a 37 point win is pretty decisive. So that was good to see and kind of help the computer rankings a little bit after the Oregon trip. Regarding kind of the bigger picture, Cal and Stanford situations. Yeah. Like my frame of reference is a little bit smaller. I kind of started really following it in maybe, you know, the late Ben Braun and then the early Mike Montgomery eras. Cal had, they had some really talented teams, especially on offense. I mean, Ryan Anderson was a stud.
Ryan Anderson was tremendous. He was a great player.
Yeah. 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 Just unbelievable skill level for his size. And yeah, I mean, that's why he played a while in the NBA, but he was great.
Jerome Randall. Yeah. Petro Christopher. Yeah.
Theo Robertson. They had Jamal Wilkes' kid was solid. They had Jamal Boykin, who transferred from Duke. I mean, they had some guys, right? And then with
Alan Crabb.
Alan Crabb, that's a great one.
Yeah, Justin Cobbs. Yeah.
Justin Cobbs. They had guys. And with Stanford, right? I mean, shoot, the Lopez twins, obviously, but, you know, even beyond them, like Lawrenceville, Anthony Goods, you know, Taj Finger was solid. They had, even in the Johnny Dawkins era, like Chase and Randall. And they had Landry Fields, right? Like they had players. And now, like, yeah, where are
Dwight
they?
Powell, right? Yeah.
I mean, Dwight Powell, that's a great one, too. He's a five-star, and he's still in the NBA. So
yeah, and Hoistus was pretty good, too, right? And Anthony,
No, just lots of names, right? I mean, you could, you know, list 20 names of guys who would easily start for either of those teams this year, right? Yeah. And be impact players. So crazy how far they've fallen. But I saw some like message board sentiment today of people being, you know, kind of, yeah, they were like bittersweet about the Pac-12 thing now. And I think you might've commented on it, but just at least my feeling on the Pac-12 thing is, you know, they can all suck it. And I am really, you know, I'm excited to see the whole thing go down the drain, except for maybe some of the Arizona fans that really care, I guess. I do feel a little bit for them.
Yeah. I mean, look, Stanford too. I mean, let's not forget. I mean, you were talking about the Ben Braun, Mike Montgomery from Cal, but, you know, when we get into Quanzo Martin, he had Jaylen Brown, who's like an NBA star now. They had
Ivan Rabb.
Ivan Rabb, a huge rate, number one player in California. I mean, Tyrone Wallace, a lot of really good players. You know, Jonah's brother, Jordan Matthews. Stanford, for their part, even in the Haas era, has had Reed Travis, KZ Apala, Dorian Pickens, the point guard that left after a year for some reason, that's like
Tyrell Terry,
who's like quit basketball at age 21, which is just a travesty.
Oscar De Silva was De Silva, really good.
And I do have to say, I think I had in watching Stanford again, I don't think it's as attributable to like poor coaching and lack of effort as I thought, just in general terms. Like, they just didn't look very talented to me. I don't think that Harrison Ingram is nearly as talented as kind of we're thinking. You know, he's been better as the season's gone on, but there are guys who do what he does, and they just do it better than he does, quite frankly, out there in college basketball in general, kind of like 6'7", 3/4 type players who can shoot threes and, you know, kind of play the point a little bit. He's not as good as he should be. And like, you know, his offensive rebounding rate should be much higher. You know, he's only shooting 44% from two in the season. I mean, he should be shooting like 55% from two. So, you know, he's not at the level that I thought he was at. And I think both of us probably thought he was at. We saw like last season, Spencer Jones really close strong. He still has the ability to get very hot, but he's kind of a limited player, you know, what he can do. And then the rest of the guys, you know, guys like Renaud and I mean, Haas has really shored up like his rotation this year. He's not using like 13 guys anymore. Like James Keefe is not really playing anymore. So he's relying really principally on these two Michael guys at guard, O'Connell and Jones. And then he's, you know, got Angel and Renaud at kind of the big guys coming in there. They're not bad basketball players. I guess it's just like, they're not plus basketball players at this level. And that's kind of, I think they're just lacking plus high major talent. I mean, like, I can't say Max Renaud is not a high major player. I'm not going to say that, but he's definitely not like a plus high major player. Right. And that's what I think.
They kind of trade athleticism for size, right? Like they are big.
They are big. Although as big as they are, they should be better at like defending the 2-point shot, which I mean, they should be able to defend the 2-point shot without giving us wide open threes every time we want to shoot it. Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't know if that's a coaching decision or not. I mean, I know we only shot like 47% from two in that game and there were some issues, but like they didn't even like try to cover the 3-point shot. It was just like, you guys just take it, you know, and hopefully you won't make them. And, you know, we're not that bad that we're just going to blow every single wide open 3-point shot. You know, it's kind of crazy. Like Reese, who came back for this game, like I think he had two wide open 3-point shots to start and just blew those. And then later on, like after he hit a mid-range jumper, he like just, you know, he dribbled his way into two 3-pointers and made both of those. So it's like what he needed to do was like, it was like he was too open, but like in general, you know, I mean, they were giving Drew wide open shots and Boogie was just like, you know, I knew going into the game that they probably the way Boogie's played this season, which I think we both agree, he's probably been the number one point guard in the conference, right? I mean, it's hard to even not point guard,
guard. Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to even like who's in the competition, right? So I didn't think that they would be able to cover him. They just had to like hope that he missed shots and like, no, he didn't. So they just don't look that good. And I was thinking it was more about coaching, and I think maybe it might just be more about recruiting. He's just got to recruit better players, you know?
Yeah. I know they had Dallaire and he transferred out to USD. So it's, I don't know. I mean, you know, the results are what they are, whether it's recruiting or coaching, like he hasn't made the NCAA tournament. Like,
no. And it's not like he's getting closer, you know, it's like they're getting further away, but. Well, that's that. I guess we could do a quick recap on as we're going to the Mountain Schools. We're going to play Colorado on Thursday, and we're going to talk about that. And we're going to play Utah on Saturday. These are because we lost that Oregon State game. These are critical games from us making the NCAA tournament. I just looked on our buddy Joe Lenardi's list. We're still first four out. We entered basically the Cal game, I think, first four out. We're still first four out. We're in a tricky spot because it's kind of like hard for us to move up too much unless we have like a really good showing in these games, because we're just the rest of the conference just isn't good. So like almost every home game we play, it's just not helping us at all. We've got to win on the road. That's the only way you can move up. Right now where we are in the conference is Oregon got swept in Washington. They're now 15-13. I guess they're still like second four out or something, but I don't think that they can unless they get to the finals of the Pac-12 tournament, I think they might, you know, that's a shot that they could get in. So they win the rest of their games, get to the finals and lose. I think they might need to win the Pac-12 tournament. I'm not entirely sure about that, but they're, like I said, 15-13. Now they do have their strength of schedule is good. So that's good for them. But I don't see them making it. And then the other two teams behind us, Utah and Arizona State, you know, Utah got swept in Arizona. And Arizona State did beat Utah, but then they lost, came back, lost to Colorado on Thursday. So I think what would you say right now is what teams are possibly could make it as at large a Pac-12 other than the top three, and what are the odds on those teams?
I think that Oregon, if they make the final of the Pac-12 tournament and lose, they could get in, but I would bet against it. I think that Washington trip just cooked them. Huge missed opportunity there for them. If they sweep that, I think they're very much in the picture, but that's just a really tough one for them. Utah, I think Utah could get in, but they probably have to beat both USC and UCLA and Colorado. I think they got to go 3-for-3 and maybe win like a game or two. So it's the window is open for them. Especially with that Arizona win, that was a big one. But I think the odds of it happening are less than 10%. Then with Colorado, I think if they win out and lose in the Pac-12 tournament final, you know, they've got that win over Tennessee, and the A&M neutral looks good in the non-con. But and then assuming they do that, I think their computer numbers would get into the top like 35-40 to make them a viable option. But again, the odds of them doing that, I would say less than 10%. So realistically, I think you're looking at Arizona, UCLA, and SC, and that's probably it. ASU, right?
ASU is actually the best positioned according to Bracket Matrix right now. Now they're in two brackets out of like 104, and Oregon's only in one. So it's not like, it's not like they're doing any seriously any better. I mean, they're basically out of it too.
If they thing with them, right? Their last three is brutal. They've got at Arizona and then at the LA schools. So that's
If they were to sweep that, I mean, I think KenPom probably has them at somewhere around, 1% to sweep those games, 2%. So 16%, 11%, 33%. You're right around 1% to sweep those games. If they were to do that, I think, they're in.
they're in if they do it.
Yeah, they're in.
No, absolutely. If they go 2-for-3, I mean, never say never, right?
No, exactly. Well, especially the 2 or 3 are Arizona and UCLA, right? Because those are, I guess, all three of these will be tier one games. But these were like super tier. I don't know, are you buying this? I don't know if you saw this little argument I got into. Do you think it's such a thing as not tier, but quad one on the road, quad two on the road versus quad one, quad two?
What's the question?
Oh, I don't know. I guess you didn't see that. I got into a little bit of a debate on one of the message boards.
I missed this.
Well, okay, yeah. So we're just kind of arguing, and I wasn't arguing, just kind of discussing different positions and where people, you know, where teams stood, and somebody who's a prominent poster and a smart and a bright guy, right? But he kind of justified one of the arguments by saying that this game was more critical because it was a and this is a discussion we should talk about. Is UCLA? How can you justify UCLA's position in the top 16 that was released on Saturday? So he justified it by saying that UCLA was something like 1-4 in quad one games on the road, or something like that. And I said, well, okay, but they're 4-4 in quad one games, and I've never heard of a distinction between quad one and quad one on the road, and. You know, I think he was arguing, oh, well, I've heard it. They've made these points. And I mean, to me, a quad one, generally speaking, quad one on the road should be might be easier, right? Because you're playing potentially a borderline top 70 team, right? So you could get a quad one, you could get a quad one on the quote unquote on the road, by playing someone of the caliber of, let's say, like Wisconsin, as opposed to if you play at home, you have to play a team of the caliber of, you know, Purdue or something like that. So, no, location matters.
For example, like Washington State roads quad one.
Correct. Right? Yes. So, yeah, home road matters a lot, but I don't think the selection committee draws a distinction between quad one and quad one on the road or quad one away from home, because I think it's built into the quad system.
No, I think that's totally right. But I do think, like, if you're beating a top 30 team on the road, that's a big freaking deal.
Right? Oh, yeah. So like, that's like, right. I think Corbett calls those like quad 1A, you know, where you're basically like, you're like, it's like a super quad one, right? You're, you know, these are elite. Yeah. So, and Arizona State's got back-to-back super quad one games, right? At Arizona, at UCLA. I mean, those are the two toughest games you can basically play west of the Rockies, right, in college basketball, because I think they're both better than Gonzaga. So the two toughest games you could possibly play are at Arizona, at UCLA, and Arizona State's going to have those back-to-back. So, yeah, they were to win those two. They're probably in. But,
I've got a gripe with the whole like selection committee process and the whole discussion, the whole narrative surrounding just the way teams are selected. So, and then Indiana is a kind of a classic example of this, them getting into that 16. But all these like analysts and people, that all they seem to value is quad one wins and then bad losses, right? So like, if you just look at, like, let's say any team hypothetically, let's say they beat UCLA, you know, home or road, whatever, it's quad one. And then they lose a home game to ASU, which is quad two, right? And then you have another team that beats ASU and gets a quad two win and then loses to UCLA. I think the media and the whole narrative would look way more favorably upon the team that beat UCLA and then lost to ASU as opposed to the reverse, even though both teams were 1-1. Right.
Right. 100%. Well, and I think it's I don't know if people, like Gary Parrish was even talking about the way he was doing his top 25 and one and how closely it was to what the selection committee picked in their top 16. And the concept of he constantly talks about quad one, quad two records. Isn't that supposed to be baked into the net ranking as it is? So like if those things are already baked into the net ranking, why is it being counted as a separate metric? It's like you're double counting that metric, right? I mean, and it does place special importance on like these quad one games, right? And then not losing quad four games. And it really makes you think you should just basically just make sure you play out of conference quad one games every game. if you could do that, like it's almost like wins and losses don't matter because they're double counting the quad one wins to the extent you could, and they're not counting them against you.
Just game the whole thing. Like Indiana's lost 8 games and they were ranked like number 13 or something.
Yeah. That to me brings up the point is I get that's supposed to be like you know, the successor to the RPI ranking, but what is the purpose of the net ranking if they're gonna ignore it? Now I'm glad they ignore it because I don't think it's right. Whatever they did in creating that algorithm, it's clearly inferior to the other algorithms, right? Whether it's the, you know, pure points per possession algorithms like KenPom and Torvik, or the kind of like margin of victory and victory algorithm like Sagarin. I mean, Nanette is clearly the least of those, but at least purports to have an algorithm attached to it, which, you know, you know, like not just an algorithm, but like a statistical regression algorithm, which, you know, the RPI did not have. So it's like, it's better, but like, it's not clear to me, like the purpose of even it existing. Why not just create an actual, like just objective metrics, tell everybody what they are and, you know, plug it in. And then we can kind of, and if we're going to use the eyeball test, make it limited to things like injuries. Don't try to like over you know, overguess like, you know, UCLA's record and this and that. And, you know, just like, let's come up with like a common set of criteria that everybody can get on board with. Like margin of victory matters, but it doesn't matter after like, you know, 27 points or whatever it is. Just, yeah. You know, let's have an objective standard for everybody. Because like, I do have to say, like, I think it's like Mick Cronin is talking about, like, it seems like a conspiracy against UCLA for leaving the Pac-12. I don't think that that's like a plausible explanation, but it is 100% true that there's no valid reason that UCLA should be ranked by the selection committee several spots below their worst ranking in every major metric, whether it's KenPom, Torvik, Sagarin, Haslam, or the net. I don't think they're below number five in any of those. And yet, for some reason, the selection committee has come up with some criteria on their own, which I guess takes into account this like quad one thing, to put UCLA down at number eight. You know, so yeah, I do have this. It does not make sense to me. And I think they just need to. I mean, I think we're getting to the age of like data, the advanced metrics age, where the analytical age, so to speak. You can't. I just think they're going to have to come up with like criteria that are just more objective and make sense to people, because like that was to me like it's hard to justify. Like, how do you justify that? But I don't know.
Yeah, there's also just a total lack of transparency around the net algorithm, right? To the point where, like, of course you're going to have people like, you know, not trusting it, right? And I completely agree. Like, I think UCLA got totally hosed. I don't think it's because they're moving to the Big Ten. But you know, like that, then again, like the Arizona AD is on that selection committee, and yeah. You know, they're a couple spots below Arizona. I would take UCLA's resume over Arizona's. I mean,
yeah, I mean, I think if you're going by resume, you kind of like, I know Arizona won head to head, and of course, the game was at McHale. And if Arizona beats them at Pauley, I guess they have an argument, but yeah, realistically, the difference between the two teams really isn't based upon strength of schedule. I mean, that's a factor, but it's a small factor. The big difference between the two teams is that UCLA, by and large, has lost to good teams, really good teams, and Arizona has lost to a bunch of teams that kind of leave you scratching your head. I mean, that's the difference, right? Not that these are – I mean, I think Washington State is actually a pretty good team at times, but, you know, a home loss is a tough one. Losing at Stanford, you know, I know Stanford's won a lot of games, and losing at Utah is kind of a strange one to me, but, you know, it was early in the season. I don't blame them for losing at Oregon, but it wasn't really a competitive game. Oregon went for fun, so very much like our game. So, I don't think there's, like, a really good argument for putting here. And I was – looking. I'm an Arizona advocate. I picked them to win the conference. I don't think it's a really good argument to put them ahead of UCLA, but, you know –
So here's another one. So the whole, like, I don't know if you've watched any of these ACC games recently, but there's this big push among kind of like the announcers to the ACC, these ACC games, to say how like disrespected the ACC is by all the bracketologists, you know, just given the tradition and the history of the league, which is complete nonsense. And I'm like, I'm watching this and just thinking, okay, I'm looking at Pitt's resume. Okay, like Pitt's 4-3 in quad one. Our team's 3-5. So they've played one fewer quad one game and they have one more win. You know, by and large, we've had a stronger schedule. We have the same amount of losses. We're 5-1 in quad two. They're 3-3. You know, and then they have a quad three loss and a quad four loss, and so do we. So, like, on paper, you know, they're pretty similar resumes. They're 19-8. We're 19-8. We've played one extra quad one game. We've played the same amount of quad two games. And then we've played more quad three and fewer quad four. They've played 10 quad four. So if you look at strictly, just look at the quadrants, we have a slightly tougher schedule. We have the same record. And yet, like, Pitt is several seed lines ahead of us in almost every single, you know, one of these bracket predictions. I don't get it at all. It's amazing to me.
That was going to be it, because if you go by KenPom this season, and KenPom, I think, is to a certain extent
higher than them in KenPom too, right?
Well, right. But I mean, the ACC is below the Mountain West, and it's not all that close, actually. I think you know, it's barely, you know, it's barely closer to the Mountain West, the ACC, is than to the American Athletic Conference, which is below it. So it's not a good banner year for the ACC. I mean, seventh amongst conferences. And yet, I think the consensus is that notwithstanding that, that the Pac-12 is fifth and ACC is seventh, Pac-12 is going to have at most three schools in the tournament, maybe only two if SC doesn't make it in because it's all literally on the bubble. And the ACC is like, has six like shoo-ins, I guess, maybe Virginia, Miami, Pitt, Duke, North Carolina State. I guess, are those the only shoo-ins?
Yeah, five.
Yeah, and then, you know, I guess then you got to look to see if whether or not. So, but yeah, no, they've gotten the benefit of the doubt. You know, they've gotten the bit, and they also have, you know, Louisville is just as bad as Cal is. You know, they're terrible. Louisville's terrible. And we know that. I mean, like, these were two, those are the two schools. Louisville and Cal had the worst starts of the season in history of power conference schools, dating back like 30 years or something. And then, you know, it's not, you know, like, Florida State has had a really, really bad year. And we know Georgia Tech and Boston College are not good. And Notre Dame has not had a good year either. So they've got a lot of really bad teams. They've got teams like, you know, Virginia Tech, which are more kind of middling. But I think Virginia Tech is like a very similar school, like Washington State, Arizona State. Syracuse, I don't think is very good. Who would win between Syracuse and Stanford and Angel Court? I mean, I have no idea. You know, like, Stanford probably actually should win that game, quite frankly. And Wake Forest, Stanford on neutral court. I mean, you know, they on neutral court, Wake Forest lost to Loyola Marymount. I know that was early in the season and all that stuff, but still, you know, you just don't, it's hard to tell. So
LSU beat them too.
Yeah, LSU beat them. And look, we have our bad loss too. I mean, so it's not like, but still, it's not a banner year for the ACC. So I don't think that they should be, it's just a weird, I think it's a weird situation where the Pac-12 is facing a scenario where potentially only two teams are going to make it. And then you've got these conferences that are clearly below them in strength, like the ACC and the Mountain West, which are going to have more teams than the Pac-12. You know, the Mountain West is like San Diego State is a lock. Boise State basically has played themselves into a lock. Now that you have like Nevada and Utah State trying, you know, getting maybe in New Mexico. So anyway, it's a rough year. We're like broken record. Thank God we're getting out of this conference, but it's like a real, like making the NCAA tournament for the Pac-12 has become like more and more and more difficult, right? Like you just do not get any help. I mean, we beat Auburn in the out of conference. We you know, kind of had, you know, Tennessee on the ropes, so almost beat them. BYU out of conference. We were 11-5 in conference and currently on the bubble. And we have, you know, so it just goes to like how weak the Pac-12 teams play on, you know, on the perception nationally, and I guess on the matrix too, or the metrics too. So, anyway,
Chase, what do you make of North Carolina being in any bracket right now?
Well, are they in any bracket? They're in 14. Wow, 14 brackets. That does tell me that if you go by back bracket matrix, what it does tell me is because there's 104 brackets out there in bracket matrix, and the last at large team that's in is we're second. It's us in Wisconsin, and we're well ahead of Wisconsin, but Wisconsin's on 67 of the 104 brackets. After that, the three that are just out, New Mexico's only in 18, North Carolina's on 14, Utah State's on 13. What it tells me is we are very, very, very well positioned to at least get in as the final four in, you know, and potentially have to play the Tuesday game, because I don't think we're going to fall, unless we just come completely like, you know, fall apart here. We should not fall behind North Carolina, but
they're 0-8 in quad one, Chase.
They were 0-9 until like, I think one of their quad ones fell out. So
went to quad two.
Yeah. Worse. So, I mean, look, for we talked about this, like North Carolina for a large part of the season, their best win was Ohio State. And then Ohio State just lost every single game starting at some point. So, I mean, where are they now? North Carolina, they're 44 and they're still 44 in Kemp. I mean, it's amazing. And North Carolina's lost 5 of 6, only win against Clemson in the last 6, lost to Wake Forest, lost to NC State. I mean, I guess these are the best teams they're probably looking, they got Notre Dame, then Virginia home. So, and then Duke home. So they do have two games that potentially are potential quad one games at home that they could win, but I don't know.
How about this? USC in the first two quadrants is 8-6. You know what Duke is in the first two quadrants?
Oh gosh, I'm sure much lower, right? 7-11 or something. What are they?
They're 7-8. So we're 8-6, and they're 7-8. And yeah. Joe Lenardi's got them on the 6th line.
Well, that's it.
I get it. Like, we've got two bad losses, right? But even if you factor that in, like, we should be seated pretty similarly.
That gets kind of the, like, I think the best, when we're talking about when you incorporate wins and losses, you kind of have to go, I think, a little bit with Sagarin, because he actually encompasses wins and losses. He's got Duke at number 34. So basically what he's telling you is Duke should be a 9 seed. He's got USC at 39, which is saying USC should be a 10 seed.
That sounds right to me. Like that passes the smell test, right?
Yeah. So he's got his top four are Sagarin, now I'm talking about, or Alabama, Houston, Kansas, UCLA. By the way, I think that my top four would be the exact same top four. That would be my 4-1 seeds. Even with Alabama's problems that we're exposed to today, which I guess we talked about that too. But, we watched Kansas play last night, and they are not unstoppable, but they are good. They are good. They're not unstoppable. They are good. They score when they need to, and they got the guys. What's really nice about their team, and I have to give credit to Bill Self, like those guys know their roles. They know exactly what their roles are on the team. There's no question, like, who's going to do what to try to win the game at the end. And they just do that really, really beautifully. But yeah, like, I think you could almost just use Sagarin and just go one through whatever 44. Right off Sagarin, and you know he has Pitt at 46, so they wouldn't. I mean, he has Oregon above them, so like Pitt wouldn't necessarily even be in. So yeah, I mean, I would just go straight down the line, Sagarin. I mean, I think that'd be much more fair than whatever the selection committee has done, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I like to look at too is the like KenPom luck rating. So. KenPom has, they have USC at 47 and they have USC at 92 in the luck rating. So they have USC as a lucky team, which implies that their resume is stronger than their computer numbers.
Correct.
And yet still, like, our computer numbers is at 47, right? So our resume is much higher than that, given that we're, top 100 luck rating out of the 360, three teams, right? And yet, so I don't understand why we're even having this conversation. Like, it's mind blowing to me. It kind of reminds me of a few years ago where SC was a 6 seed with the Evan Mobley team. That was just absurd. I mean, the whole everything around that. I guess it's because they like lost to the mountain schools, and people thought that Colorado team with McKinley Wright wasn't really that good, even though they were a top 10 Ken Palm
team. That was the Gary Parrish calling them the computer trickers. They call them computer trickers. When we having watched them play, like, no, these guys are good. They play basketball.
Exactly. And then you got all the experts picking Patrick Ewing and Georgetown against them in the tournament, and they beat them by 23 in the first round. I thought that was great. No, I mean, I think we're kind of rambling on here, but it's mind blowing to me, the lack of respect for the conference, and that it continues to get just shafted over and over again. Right? It's crazy.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about this game, these coming games against Colorado and Utah. So, there was another post where someone was saying, oh, I think, got to try to beat Colorado because Utah is going to be the tougher game. I think actually I think it's pretty well settled that Colorado right now is a better team than Utah. Now, we don't know what things are going to turn out. Also, playing in Boulder, I think right now is going to be tougher than playing in Salt Lake City. Both these games are winnable games. Utah is missing, we, as far as I understand, right, they are, they will not have Gabe Mattson for this game, right?
Believe he, that's right.
Okay, he hasn't played for the last like 3 weeks. He hasn't played any time in February. And he's essentially like their best kind of like perimeter player. You know, obviously the best player by far is Brandon Carlson. He's kind of like the best perimeter player or scorer. Colorado, they've had a weird kind of up and down recent times in the conference. And it kind of goes with what they were doing earlier in the season. They've won 3 of 5. They swept the Bay Area schools at home, which is more impressive than, you know, they beat Stanford at home by 18. That's probably one of the best games performances of the season, really, because Stanford has been playing so well otherwise. Then they go the very next game and lose on the road to Utah by like 10, come back, beat Arizona State away, play Arizona tough for a while, and then kind of let the game get away from them. We obviously beat them the first time around at Galen in a weird game where we like came out really hot, and then I think that's when we used the entire, we used every player on scholarship and got them in the game in the first half. And by the time the halftime rolled around, it was like tied. And then we had to win the game in the second half. They, that game, when we played them the first time around, like it, to me, at least it was clear, like, okay, we're like a better team, at least at Galen. We were like a better team, you know? And wasn't like, you know, De Silva didn't, we shut him down. But Lovering had a huge game against us, and Javon Ruffin had a huge game against us. But they're two big guys, KJ Simpson and Silva, kind of got shut down. Now, I could definitely see a scenario where when playing them in Boulder, those guys are going to just feel a whole lot better. De Silva, who's been arguably the best scorer in the conference for, you know, some period of time here, has had a tremendous conference season, has a huge game. KJ Simpson has been up and down. He has not played recently as well as he had played earlier in the season, basically since the new year, right? So when we got into conference play in earnest, he hasn't really had like a lot of like over 100 rating offensive games. He's had only about 3 of them out of, you know, since the conference play started in earnest. So it's been a kind of a up and down for him. They can beat us for sure. They play very good defense. They're going to play very good defense at home. I am very worried about our shooting in, you know, Mile High area of the country. You know, it's a weird situation. At the same time, what I do like going for us is with Morgan and Reese playing against Stanford, it just, our deep, we just kind of look better overall. Like it just, there was less uncertainty. And I just got, you get the feeling that we just, our personnel situation was just better, you know, like it's clear, like not having those guys made a big impact. So
did Reese look a little more athletic to you against Stanford? He looked a little more athletic than me.
Yeah, I think so. He had a nice steal and breakaway dunk. And, you know, I mean, I really think a lot of, I mean, some of whatever happened with Reese, I think a lot of it is it's part physical that led to mental. And you can see that with the shots, right? Like he can't hit a wide open three, but if he dribbles into a three, he'll hit it, you know? You know, and so a lot of that is just mental for him and getting in the right rhythm. I don't know what it's going to be like up in, it's going to be up like in Boulder. I think a lot of it's going to be dependent on Boogie shooting. If Boogie can hit shots, I think we'll win. If he doesn't, we're going to struggle.
Yeah, you can say that for a lot of our games this year,
yeah,
by the way.
Yeah.
Thanks of God. I think it's a decent matchup for us. Kobe was really good on Simpson, or not on Simpson, on De Silva in that first game. He turned him over a lot, and De Silva can't really like blow by him, and De Silva's not really strong enough to like overpower him. He's just a really, yeah, that's a really good matchup for him, I think, because De Silva, he can shred other guys. I mean, he can take like smaller guys in the post, and he can take, you know, the slower footed guys outside, but Kobe's, you know, he's a jack of all trades, and it's just a tough matchup for De Silva. So I really like that. I think they might struggle to score against us. Now, like, we really have to be disciplined on guys like Ruffin. And we cannot give up threes, because that's how you get kind of run out of Colorado, right? Like their role guys start hitting threes and the crowd gets really into it, and then you're done. Yeah. Right. So we got to be really disciplined on our assignments, but if we are, I think we have the better players and can pull it off.
Yeah.
with Utah, I like our chances. I mean, Carlson, he might get his 20, right? He's really good. But our role guys just seem so far superior to them talent wise. And then you have this, this Utah defense, which especially in the non-conference early, they were just ridiculously good at defending the three and the two. And that's kind of mean regressed a little bit. They're now seventh in the conference in 2-point defense, in league play. Teams still can't shoot threes against them, which is just kind of crazy. But it wasn't great for them in the desert. I mean, Arizona beat them by 26 at McHale, wasn't a big surprise. And, they lost to ASU by 8. So I wouldn't say like they're downward trending, but they clearly miss Madsen. I mean, scoring 59 and 62 in the desert games isn't great. To the point where I think if we can hit a few threes in that game, we should be able to get through it.
Yeah, I mean, look, they're lost now 4 of 6. Now, some of that is scheduling, right? I mean, they basically just finished a road trip to the desert, and then they had an away game in Oregon, which I don't think any of us expect them to win. They did before that. They didn't win three in a row. They swept the Washington schools at home and beat Oregon State on the road, which we failed to do. But that all being said, since essentially the end of January, the only teams they've beaten are California at home and Colorado at home. Now, Colorado at home is a good win. That's for sure a good win, but that's like one good win in 4 weeks, which is, it's tough, when you're in this part of the season. So yeah, I would say that they're not trending in the best direction. In that game, that win, the game they did beat Colorado, that was like a big Ben Carlson game. I think that was, or not, I guess Brandon Carlson had a big game too, but it was a game where Colorado really, really struggled to score, which is we've seen from them sometimes this season. And De Silva only had 6 points. So if he scores 6 points, they're going to lose pretty much, right? So that was kind of the story of that game. So yeah, I think these are winnable games. I feel much, much better, I have to say, heading into this mountain trip than I felt heading it up to Oregon. And it's hard to explain, like, why do I feel that way? I think one is, I think Oregon personnel wise was really well, really, really, really well suited to exploit a lot of our problems, right? Because Dante is just so dominating down low, and we're already shorthanded personnel wise. And then knowing that we were probably already coming off a really dispiriting loss, we would be heading to Oregon State, and that team is going to play super, super aggressive style against us. And we're down players. We're going to be relying a lot on freshmen. I feel like heading to this mountain trip, I feel much more like when we headed to the Arizona trip, frankly, early in the season, which was a split, and we lost to Arizona. But we played Arizona State really, really well on the road. So I feel more like that. So I don't know where this is going to end up. I'm sure the sense of urgency is with the players because they probably are seeing, that we're on the bubble, according to like everybody saying we're like last four in, last two in. So I'm sure they're going to take this game really, really seriously. I do wonder if like a team like Utah still thinks that they can get in the tournament and maybe they'll play super hard. I'm sure Colorado's going to play hard at home, but I think this is going to be, I think our team will play better than we did on the Oregon trip, is my guess.
It might be the case where like we might have to rely a little more on our veterans too. I mean, just that Colorado environment is going to be really hostile. You have the altitude, but I agree. I mean, you combine it with the fact that with the Oregon trip, it was just we're also beat up, right? I mean, Morgan and Reese didn't play in either of those games, so that's a factor. And Oregon was kind of fighting for their season, right? It was we talked about it. It was really the perfect spot for Oregon to come in and really just put in a max effort game, and they did. Is there a more devastating road trip than Oregon losing both of the Washington schools last week?
I mean, that's, I mean, I guess it goes back
In
to,
the way they lost too, right? Like.
yeah, I think everything about it and the fact that Will Richardson didn't score at all against Washington, right?
43 minutes. Yeah. No points.
It's almost like since they've gotten Bartholomew back, he's been worse, you know? It's a weird situation. And it's also a team that, like, clearly, like, Oregon does not play well away from home. Right. So yeah. if you know, they lost, yeah, what's amazing is that they had a huge win against us and make us look like idiots, and they've lost every game since. So, right. Starting with the win against Arizona at home, they had won four straight at home, and then UCLA kind of spoiled that. You know, I don't, this game in Oregon State, I think they'll win, but I'm not even sure they're going to win that game. That's a bad situation for Oregon. And, you know, we've talked a little bit about this. Ullman is an interesting recruiting class coming in next season. He's got like two McDonald's All-American level players and Kwame Evans and Mookie Cook. But the best player is probably the Shellstad guy from Oregon, who's going to be like the face of the pro. He'll probably be the last point guard that Dana Ullman coaches at Oregon. I mean, I could definitely see a scenario where Ullman retires in a few years, and that's that. And he's really good, and I don't think he's kind of short, so he's not going to leave for the NBA. So, they're going to have a big situation to see if Dante comes back next season, because this will be his fifth year, and he's had a great season, but he hasn't really positioned himself to get drafted. So I guess he could come back for a big like NIL payday. But if he doesn't come back, they're going to struggle a lot next season. So that's a weird situation. That was a devastating trip to Washington, man. But speaking of devastating trips, I'm just looking, you know, we have certainly not set the world on fire heading out to those mountain schools. Let's see. All right. Okay. So we actually swept them. I did not remember this. We swept them in the JMAC senior year. We swept them up there.
Sure did.
After that, swept in 2019, didn't play them 2020, swept in 2021. That was the Evan Mobley team got swept up there. And then last year we actually swept them. But those were two kind of down teams last year. So it was a big sweep when we got it at the time. But before that, we'd had been swept the last two times before that. So, yeah, we'll see. Well, it seems like we either go and lose both games or win both games if we don't really split. I guess we split 2017. We beat Colorado and lost to Utah. So, anyway. I don't know, how are you feeling about the results on these? What are you thinking?
I'm leaning split. I think we beat Utah, and I think the Colorado game's kind of a coin flip. I do think there's a better chance of going 2-0 than 0-2. And now I said the same thing about the Oregon trip. The Oregon State loss was a mess, but yeah, I'll say we beat Utah by 5-10, and I think we, win or lose by one at Colorado, wouldn't be surprised either way.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's going to be a huge emphasis put into Colorado, right? It's the first game. If we lose it, we could be out of the tournament for that moment. We'd have to play our way back in. So that's going to be a really, really tough. And you know, look, the next three games, Ken Pom has us losing each of the next three games, this mountain trip and then Arizona at Galen, and then has us winning Arizona State at Galen on the following Saturday. So if there's ever a time to step up and like, hey, we're in this field for sure. We're up to a 10 seed. If we sweep this weekend, we will probably be up to like a 10 seed, is my guess. And because of the situation, how far we put ourselves back with the Oregon State situation, I kind of feel like we need to do that a little bit. So, that's my take on this.
All righty. Should we move on to listener questions?
Let's do some listener questions.
All right. So let me start. My buddy JD from Houston, he chimed in, and this kind of goes back to our discussion about just the whole tournament selection process. But he said, "I just don't get tournament bids." West Virginia is 5-10 in conference play now, 12 and 16 and 12 overall. They're supposedly in the mix. Oklahoma State is only slightly better in conference. I get that they must have some quad one wins, but what's going on? So I'll just throw it to you and I'll maybe give a few thoughts too.
Well, so I can tell you what I think is going on in the minds of the selection committee, which is their record at quad one, quad two games, and the fact that they're playing basically every night they're playing a quad one game. So they're way up there in terms of just volume of quad one, and they've done pretty well. So let me look just really quick because I don't even know where they are in terms of quad one, quad two. So for quad one only, they are 5-11. So they have 5 wins and 11 losses, which is basically accounts for all their losses. They're all quad one losses. And then on quad two, they're Oh, with quad one, quad two. Yeah, so they have 1 other loss, and then four, they're 4-1 quad two. I think to say that's the reason that they're ranked so highly is essentially how tough their schedule has been and all the teams they've played. I would say for like, if you're asking for my opinion on like where should they really be like ranked, essentially, my answer to that question would be to just go to SAGRA, right? And that gives you a pretty good idea of what this team really is. And SAGRA has West Virginia at number 33. So SAGRA would have them essentially as a top the top nine seed. And that's with a 16 and 12 record. It's because they also have the fourth overall toughest schedule. It's not all that dissimilar than Michigan State. I mean, Michigan State is like 16 and 10. So when you do get to that level of tough schedules, there's just a different, you're being held to a different standard of what games you need to win and what games you don't need to win. And they did beat Oklahoma State last night, which kind of enforced to me the idea that probably they do deserve to be in the field. Now, if you're talking about just points per possession, going to like KenPom got them at number 23. So he likes them even more. So all that being said, they're about to play at Kansas, at Iowa State, and then come back and play Kansas State at home. Those are three like pretty losable games for them. If they were to lose all three, I think they might be in the there might be a question of whether or not they're actually in the field, because at that point they'd be only one game above 500. And I don't think it I think Michigan last year was like the best or the worst record ever for a at-large team. So anyway, that's my take on this, is they're in based upon just how tough the schedule is. And there's any number of ways to measure the toughness of the schedule, but I think using the best possible metrics we have, the schedule's been tough. So what's your take on them?
Yeah, I would put them in the field too. They have enough quality wins there. They don't have bad losses. It's a total strength schedule thing. And then with Oklahoma State, I think that's a little bit more interesting. I actually think West Virginia is better than Oklahoma State. And they should be, seeded higher. Now, because Oklahoma State, I mean, they lost Southern Illinois at home, right? It's either a quad three or four loss, right? And then some of their quad one wins aren't like the best. I mean, beating Oklahoma on the road is a quad one win, for instance, right? And Oklahoma, they're sub 500, they're 13 and 14.
Of course, Oklahoma did beat Alabama at home by like 30 points. So that's maybe tougher game than giving credit for, but
No, that's true too. So, no, it's a tough league. I mean, I think your Michigan State point was really interesting, because I personally, like, if I'm playing either West Virginia or Michigan State, I would fear West Virginia way more than I would Michigan State. And like, I don't even think West Virginia is like an elite team, but you look at Michigan State, they don't have a ton of like athleticism. They don't have like the shot making that West Virginia has either. And like, this team's now like 8-7 in Big Ten play. They lost to Notre Dame. Notre Dame blew them out, and Notre Dame's awful. And Like the other thing with the Big Ten is all these Big Ten teams are getting just a free quad one win every time they play Ohio State on the road, which is just it's insane, but it's pumping all their resumes, right? Ohio State's in total free fall. They're a terrible team, but you know, if you win in Columbus, it's now like a quad one win. So I don't get that at all, but it's all part of like the NCAA's algorithm around the net, just being kind of a piece of crap, I think. So,
Does your friend have any more questions?
that is it.
Okay, I will read one, and then I'll from David, who's submitted questions in the past. Thank you, David. So keep submitting them; we really appreciate it. Our transition offense is excellent, but it seems to me that more often recently, our half court game has devolved into Boogie and Drew going one on one, and either driving, followed by a follow away from Drew, or shooting deep threes when they are blazing hot, as they were this weekend. We win when they're not. Usually away from Galen, we struggle. Do you agree with this observation? And how will that play in the Pac-12 tournament and NCAA tournament when we're not in our home gym? I will let you talk, address that first, Nick.
I mean, I think every team to an extent, you know, like if their team may, I think like any team would say, oh, we're really tough, if we make threes, right? So yeah, like I think that's true. I think Boogie, you know, maybe you could say he's better at home. Like he had that UCLA performance, certainly at home, right? And you know, the Stanford performance was also at home, so I think there's definitely some truth to that, but he hasn't been a total, you know, mess on the road either. You know, I guess he had that the weak Arizona game on the road, but he was pretty good against ASU down there. I mean, he had 18 points. You know, he was what, 5 for 11 against Washington State on the road. I guess that wasn't great. Washington, you know, on the road, he had 27 up there and kind of took over that game in the second half. So, you know, he was all tournament in the Bahamas, right? So, I thought he was
What
pretty
about
good.
his kind of early the earlier part of the question, which is the devolution of our offense? We're like it's definitely gotten to points of the season, and certainly second half against UCLA at home, where it's like we're just essentially just like letting Drew and Boogie go one on one. It seems like I'm not sure that's totally fair, but it sometimes seems like.
Yeah, and I think some of that is just out of necessity, right? I mean, like you have Reese isn't really like an ISO scorer, and it seems like he's had a little, you know, some confidence issues. We don't have a post threat, right? So we can't just throw the ball. I think Vince is really good when he gets deep post position, but he's still learning how to kind of get that deep post position, right? I think we've seen that on several occasions where he gets pushed off his spot and he's much less effective. And then, like, I think Trey is a great zone buster, right? Like, you can throw him in the middle of the zone against Washington, and you can attack that way. So, yeah, like, I do think there have been, but, you know, against man teams, he's been much more limited. So, I think that I do agree with David. I think our transition offense has been excellent. And I do agree that, you know, we have a lot of isolation sets for Boogie and Drew. But I think a lot of that is out of necessity. I do think that Drew on these deep fadeaways, those can be pretty low percentage shots at times. So I guess I'm okay with some of it. I would rather have Boogie taking a three, even if it's a deep three, I guess, than a Drew fade away from 18 feet.
Okay, so let me say a couple of things. One, an underrated aspect of what we've done with the offense, which I do agree is kind of reined in some of the kind of more passing stuff that we've done, is we're actually in Pac-12 play, number one in the conference in least amount of turnovers per possession. Our turnover rate leads the
Yes.
conference, which is a huge departure from the beginning of the season when we were having all kinds of problems. And I will add that we're number one in turnover rate, despite the fact that we completely melt down at end of games and turn the ball over a bunch of times sometimes when we're pressed. Basically, and Andy just admitted this in the press conference after the Stanford game, it's laziness. Like our players, literally, I mean, I watched that 1-5 count, I think that Kobe had, and he got the ball. Not one of our players moved for 3 seconds on the referee signal. And When they finally did, it wasn't a hard cut to anything. It was kind of just like a, you know, jog into a spot and like, hey, why don't you throw a jump ball and I'll catch it. So notwithstanding the fact that we really play into turnovers in those situations and we'll start games with bad turnovers, we play for like those 30 minutes in the middle of games. We're like one of the least turnover prone teams, not only like in the conference this year, but like in memory. We just do not turn the ball over very much, except for early in games when we're being frivolous, and like late in games when we're just kind of like tired and already winning and figure we're going to win the game anyway. So that style of offense, while it's not always the most visually pleasing, has helped on that in that regard. It, you know, getting a shot off is always going to be a higher percentage than turning the ball over. And generally speaking, you know, we shoot pretty well. Our effective field goal percentage in conference play is fourth overall in the conference. And we're leading the conference of free throw percentage as well. So like I'm not sure exactly where we are in true shooting percentage in the conference, but we've got to be like number one, number two. So like for us, not turning the ball over is a huge, huge thing. Like just getting a shot off, because we shoot, our true shooting percentage is so high. So yeah, it's not the most visually pleasing. I agree with that. On the Drew fadeaways, I think it just depends on what shot he's taking, right? Like when he dribbles into like those like seven, like elbow jumpers, fadeaways, like he's shooting like 90% on those. It's like he just knows he's going to make those. When he does like a post up on, you know, post up from near the baseline.
On the baseline,
That's when he's like the percentage is much, much, much lower, right? So it just depends on, and he tends to turn the ball over much more there too. So it just depends on where he's taking those shots from, quite frankly. So yeah, I agree that it has not been visually pleasing in many times. And look, we've struggled a lot in games like against Oregon State for sure. And Oregon was ugly as hell. Arizona was tough. But, you know, people have had tough games, and I think part of it is just knowing that Boogie has demonstrated he can get his shot off and get a quality look. And Drew's kind of demonstrated the same thing. And I don't – even the ball movement is sometimes better than it looks. You know, like Kobe will get his open looks here and there. If you take, like – as a whole, what we've done on offense, especially since Pac-12 play started, it's a pretty impressive, like kind of like holistic offense, with the exception of just offensive rebounding, which has not been terrible, but it's below average. But you know, we're really strong in free throws. We don't turn the ball over. We're shooting a pretty high rate from the field when we shoot from the field. So all of those things, you know, and we draw a lot of fouls too. So all those things combined, you know, I think it's made for a good offense, and is a reason that we're just behind Arizona for the most offense, for the best offensive efficiency in Pac-12 play, which is kind of shocking when you think about how this team has performed at different times in the season. But we're right at, like, I don't know if we're going to keep up this rate because we have four tough games left, but 108 points per possession adjusted in conference. That's like, for us, you know, that's better than the Evan Mobley year. Now, I don't know if we'll keep that up, but it was. And if you go back to like the best offenses, right? Like the, McLaughlin senior year, it's not quite at that level, but it's, you know, back then offenses were just better. Quite frankly, defenses hadn't caught up. So we, you know, kind of as a rate, we're better this season compared to everybody else. So I don't think the offense has been quite as bad as sometimes it looks, to answer the question. Let me ask the next one. Reese seems like he's not close to where he was last year. I agree. Any idea what's up with him? Sometimes he looks a little indifferent.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. So obviously, like, him not having an off season, I think was, you know, just with the injuries, that hurt him a lot coming into this year. And he never really found his confidence, I think. You know, he had his moments like against UCLA where he was really locked in and just had it going, and he couldn't miss from the mid range. And it was just super impressive overall. But yeah, certainly like he's had like some mental and physical lapses. And I wonder if like the physical portion has affected kind of like his mentality in a lot of these games. I will say, like, he did look, I thought, you know, in the Stanford game, we talked about like the missed wide open threes on one of them from like that left, the left wing. It was kind of like in between the left wing and the top of the key. It was just wide open. You could tell he just rushed it. Like he was just super quick into his shot mechanics. There was no one around. There was no need to rush it. So I think he just got kind of like overexcited on that one and hit the heel of the rim. But overall, like I do think like his head was pretty, he was in that game, I think mentally, and I thought he had a pretty good defensive game overall, one of his better defensive games this year. And I mean, the stroke is still there. Like I still think like long term he's going to be a very solid offensive piece. I guess the question is, can he really impact the team in these last couple weeks here this season? I don't know, but I'm hopeful that the Stanford game is a step in the right direction.
Yeah, I echo all of that. And we've talked, like, there was, I saw him live at Arizona State game, and it was not pretty. I mean, it looked like he was mentally struggling for to like just keep concentration. And I don't think it's indifference. I just think it's like it's just a struggle. And hopefully, he can snap out of it. And yeah, he definitely rushes a lot of those open looks. I do think there's an aspect to what happened. What's going on this season for him? I think he probably identified for himself that he what didn't shoot a high enough 2-point percentage last year, so he really wanted to work on his mid-range game. Very similar to what Drew did heading into last season. If everyone remembers, Drew came into last season at the beginning of the season was like, I'm just focusing entirely on my mid-range game, and he was shooting. Out, before we got to conference play, he was like shooting around like close to 60% from 2 points, but his 3-point shooting had really dipped compared to what he had done the previous season. And then for whatever reason, he decided, you know what, I'm just going to go and start shooting threes more. And when we got to conference play, his 3-point shooting over the course of the season bumped way back up. And he was shooting more threes, and he was got close to shooting 45% from three. I don't think that Reese is going to ever get to that level 3-point shooting again, but I feel like he overemphasized mid-range. You can see it, like he'll get the ball in a position of the 3-point line wide open, and he'll dribble into traffic and then take a mid-range shot. Often a very low percentage mid-range shot. So he, in his mind, it's like he's just much, you can clear, he's much more comfortable taking like a dribble into mid-range shot than he is taking a wide open 3-pointer. And that's something that's going to have to change for next season, I think. Okay. Any scoop on likely candidates for us in the transfer portal? I think I will just step in and say, I don't think it's a good idea for us to name any particular players because, first of all, we don't have any special information. But second of all, anyone we name is very unlikely to actually end up at SC. So maybe we could just discuss the type of player that might be good for us to get in the transfer portal. So I'll leave that to
Yeah,
you, Nick.
sure. Yeah, I mean, if you just look at our weaknesses this year, it's shooting, but I think it's more so defensive rebounding is the one like clear thing that stands out. So I would like to add some size. Even if it's not a center, like someone I think at power forward, we really miss Isaiah Mobley's ability to get contested rebounds. So I think a four that could rebound and maybe space the floor as well would be a really beneficial add, I think. That kind of that stands out more than even like a guard. I think we'll be okay at guard with the freshman coming in. Maybe we add a guard, maybe we don't, but on that combo-ish forward that rebounds and can maybe stretch you a bit, I think would be a huge add for this team.
Yeah, so 100% agree. And if you were to ask me, like, what is that? What separates us from being like, what separates this USC team from being like elite, like a top 10 team nationally? There's actually a lot of aspects to the way we play that are elite. I mean, we're number two in the nation in 2-point field goal percentage defense. And while our 3-point field goal percentage defense is not great, it's actually now above average. It'd be nice if it was a little better, and I think it's been much better recently when we've noticed that. our 3-point shooting has been poor for most of the season, but we're almost to the point. We'll see how things go in the mountain schools because it's obviously tough to shoot threes there, but we're almost to the point where we're at like an average nationally. Our free throw percentage has been dynamite in conference. And we obviously have not been turning the ball over in conference. The one area that's been very persistently tough for us, and we're just really, really bad, is our rebounding, and really it's our defense rebounding. So if we were to find that player that can just be a monster on the boards and stretch the court, hit some threes, be a threat, that'd be huge. Losing Boogie and Drew for next season, there's going to be like a vacuum for kind of like scoring. There's only, look, Collier is going to be terrific for us, but he's going to be a freshman, and there's going to be moments where he's going to frustrate all of us because he's a freshman. We can't put too much of a scoring burden on him. Luckily, we have a guy like Kobe Johnson who's going to be like on him from a mature, coming from a mature place to like take some of the emotional burden, like a leadership burden off of Collier. And then for the scoring burden, yeah, we're going to need like a big season from Trey White. We're going to need a big season from Vince. And we're going to really need, we're going to need Reese to get back to like what he can do. So yeah, we're going to have to find guys like a guy on a monster of the board for sure. Hopefully he can stretch the court. And then maybe one other scorer is the way I look at it. I'm very hopeful that we'll see development with Kajani Wright next season. I think both he and Vince to a degree really will benefit from just, you know, like experience rebounding, getting their hands a little bit better. Neither one of them are great. And like Josh Morgan's actually better now. I mean, he's improved. Josh Morgan's really improved with his hands over the course of him being at USC. So Vince is not like bad on that score, but he could really improve. And a lot of rebounding is just like having good hands, getting the ball and securing it. And hopefully I'm optimistic that those guys will develop into that. I was watching like there's some highlights of like this the NBA All-Star game from like 30 years ago, and like some of the passes that were going into like Shaquille O'Neal. I mean, I know Shaq takes a lot of like grief for being, oh, he's just a big dude, you know, and dunk some people, but like his hands were just ridiculous. Like you can throw the ball anywhere near him, he's gonna get the ball. Like any ball in the air near him, it's his. There's no question. Yeah. So, and just something to remind people when they're like, oh, they're not sure how good, you know, Shaq was just big. Yeah, he was a monster size, but he could move like a guy who was like 6'4", and he had hands like a guy who was 6'4".
Yep.
That's the reason it was so great. Not just because he's so big. So, anyway, that's my hope. Where are we at? Do we have anything to address before we break for the week?
I'll just make one last comment on the, you know, potential transfer portal candidates. I do think you brought up a really good point. Like Boogie is such an outstanding shot maker, and for all of our Isaiah Collier's like strengths, he's not like a, you know, dynamite shooter like Boogie is, you know, off the dribble or anything like that. And I really like Silas Demery as well, but I'm not sure like he's a shooter either. So I think you just make a really important point. Like, you know, it would be awesome to get Reese back to kind of like the NCAA tournament Reese, you know, against Miami. He was exceptional. Maybe Ozaiah kind of fills that vacuum, that shooting vacuum, but, you know, it would be, I think, it'd be worthwhile to like look into just a like late clock shot maker in the portal. I think that might be a, you know, a decent investment as well. Just, you know, even if it's just for like the second unit, right?
Before we head out, I mean, I guess we should talk about the Brandon Miller thing. I guess it's worth mentioning that apparently not only did Nate Oates know this, everything that was going on with that situation, which kind of like came out today during a trial. Is that, am I right? It came out during trial today?
I don't even know.
So somehow this information was released, and I think it had to do something with a court proceeding, came out. Not only did Nate Oates know about it, but the Alabama athletic director, Greg Byrne, knew all about this. So this is, even though it had not been made public before, everyone seemed to have known that Brandon Miller was responsible for bringing a loaded gun to the location where that gun was later used as part of a homicide, right? So where there's a criminal case involving the homicide. And they're, you know, look, they're saying it's he would, you know, he does not face criminal liability. I suppose that appears to be the case from what I can tell, because he has never been arrested as far as we know or charged with anything. And obviously a lot of the national media is all over this. Like, how can he continue playing? Which is an interesting point. But at the same time, if he hasn't been charged with anything, I mean, obviously does not show good judgment to bring a loaded gun to any situation like this. Like, I think, you know, I'm a gun rights person, so I think there are circumstances where you do, it's okay to bring a loaded gun, but I don't think this was one of them. And I, so like, certainly 18 year old or how old he is should not be running around with a loaded gun with his buddies, ever. Like, that's never the right time to have a loaded gun in that situation. I mean, if they're going to all, if they're all going to the gun range, that's fine. that was not what's going on here. So
not quite. No.
Yeah. So that shows extremely poor judgment, but the fact that like Oates hasn't done anything about it, the athletic director hasn't done anything about it, I guess is one of the issues. Like, there's, he hasn't been charged with anything, even at a misdemeanor level. I guess maybe he gets by on this. And I just don't know. There's no mechanism in place that I see that's going to prevent Brandon Miller to continue playing. And by the way, we should, I mean, he's like the number one freshman in the country this year in college basketball. He's going to be a top five NBA pick, or at least he was up to this moment. And there's no mechanism in place that I know, I'm aware of, that's going to stop him from playing from Alabama. And I don't know what repercussions there's going to be for Oates or Byrne unless somebody from the Alabama administration decides that the national pressure is just too high and they got to do something. But I have a feeling that's not going to happen. So I think it's either like everybody gets fired and he stops playing, or it's just like this gets, we're just moving on to the next thing.
Yeah, I would bet on the latter. You know, just given that it's Alabama too, and the SEC, they're kind of like a win at all costs institution. So I think that's probably the way this goes. Hey, you know, I could be wrong. Like, if the public pressure ramps up enough, just, you know, to give a little context on the situation. So this is Darius Miles, who is a former men's basketball player at Alabama. He wasn't the shooter, but he was charged in the murder. So apparently, so the cops said that Brandon Miller delivered the murder weapon to Miles at Miles's request. And then Miles told his friend, Michael Davis, who was the trigger man, where the gun was located. But then, like, beyond that, Brandon Miller's car and Jaden Bradley's car, so Jaden Bradley's one of Alabama's lead guards, were blocking the road where the victim's car was parked. And Brandon Miller's car was also struck by two bullets. And, you know, they haven't said, you know, whether those cars were intentionally blocking the road before shots were fired. But, you know, Nate Oates coming out and saying, oh, you know, like, Brandon's a college kid. He's was in the wrong place at the wrong time. I mean, that's a pretty tough look, you know, these days.
Right? It's a hard explanation when you're at the wrong place at the wrong time and your gun is being used as the weapon that results in a murder charge. That sounds like more than a wrong place, wrong time scenario. But, you know, I don't know what to say because I don't know who's going to do anything.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, I mean, it'll be interesting to see, like, if this affects Miller's draft status at all too. I mean, that's another factor here, but, yeah, like, Bama, like, they're absolutely national title contender. So, you know, if Miller misses any time here, it'll certainly, you know, open up the field even more.
Yeah, it will open up the field more. And it's just there's a situation, obviously, that's gone on with the New Mexico State basketball program where there was also, you know, violence involved. And I mean, you know, these guys are headed for being, like, not all of them, like Darius Miles, but like Brandon Miller is going to be a millionaire, multimillionaire. You know, like, he's going to make a ton of money playing professional basketball. Just, you got to avoid stuff like this. Like, just do not put yourself in these situations under any circumstances. Do not, you know, do not bring guns out to, like, social situations where there's going to be conflict. You know, if you need it for protection, that's one thing, but don't bring it. Don't initiate an encounter that's going to result in some sort of, you know, potential violence, you know, and bring a gun to that situation. So just don't do it. And, you know, you just got to, these kids have got to show better judgment. And I think this will, in my opinion, damage Nate Oates. I mean, although he just got a contract extension too, didn't he? Like 2 weeks ago.
Oh, is that right?
That's crazy. I think he just got extended. So,
oh wow.
Yeah. So, and obviously his extension came with full knowledge of this. So I don't know how could he possibly be disciplined? Where they say we're fired for cause, even though we knew exactly the situation that we're firing you for before we just give you a new contract. I don't think that's going to fly. So, yeah, I mean, I think it will harm Nate Oates' reputation nationally for a period of time. But, you know, I mean, it's been particularly bad because there was an actual person who died here. I mean, that's terrible. It's horrible. So,
obviously, like, it's a horrific situation, and, you know, obviously, like, our hearts go out to the victim and their family. But I did see, like, an interesting little, like, Twitter meme saying, NBA scouts are loving Brandon Miller's ability to create shots for us.
Yes, I saw it. I retweeted that myself. So, well, I already put on our podcast description, I said the Brandon Miller shooting exploits. Okay. So I think that's it. Game Thursday, game Saturday. If you're in the mountain areas, you know, Denver area or Salt Lake City, try to get out to the game and cheer for a team. These are big games. Trying to make the NCAA tournament. Any last thoughts, Nick?
I think I'm good. Chase, do you want to make your picks on the games? Are you thinking 1-1 or?
God, I'm going to go 2-0.
What the hell? I like it.
Yeah. All righty. Hopefully, fight on.
Fight on.